One of the great privileges of hosting a conference like this is having so many wonderful friends come to campus and to be able to visit with so many of you. And it's been a delight to see you and look forward to ongoing conversations over the next 2 days. We've been blessed with four wonderful sessions, and this one I am confident will be no exception. One of the great leaders in the world of Christian higher education today is Dr. Dwayne Litvin. Dr. Litvin has served as president at Wheaton College for the past 17 years and done so in an exemplary way. When people talk about Wheaton College in days to come, they will talk of Dwayne Litvin the way people have talked about Blanchard's in years gone by. On the campus, that central administrative building on the beautiful Wheaton campus is the Blanchard Hall, which tells you all you need to know about that hallowed name, and people will speak of Dwayne in those same tones in years to come. He is a magnificent leader, a brilliant scholar, a great thinker, incredibly articulate communicator and preacher, and we are blessed to have him here. One of the delights that I've had in my time and service here at Union is getting to know Dr. Litvin. We served together for 6 years on the board of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, and he became a very special and trusted colleague, and his counsel and advice on many matters here has been something for which I'll always be grateful. But his work, particularly on conceiving the Christian college, is a work I would commend to you as essential reading for understanding the calling of Christian colleges and the unique work that they have to do. Dr. Litvin was well prepared to come to this position. As many of you know, he was pastoring not too far down the road at the First Evangelical Church in Memphis, Tennessee. Before that, he had taught at Dallas Theological Seminary. He holds two earned doctorates, one in communications from Purdue University, another in New Testament from Oxford. He is as well prepared to speak to this topic today because of his role as the president of what many think is the intersection of the evangelical world there at Wheaton College. And we've asked him today in our conference on Southern Baptist Evangelicals and the Future of Denominationalism to address the question, the future of evangelicalism. And he is not necessarily a prophet, but as insightful as anyone we know to explore this issue. So would you join me, please, in welcoming my good friend and our colleague for this hour, Dr. Dwayne Litvin.
Thank you, David. Great. Thank you. And David, I want to thank you for that very generous introduction, overly lavish, undoubtedly, but it still feels good. You are blessed to have David Dockery at this institution here at Union, and those of you who are part of the more extended Southern Baptist Communion are blessed to have David in your midst to giving leadership. I've said before on this campus that David is an unusual leader. He is a leader among leaders. When the leaders get together, they choose David to chair it. Why? Because David has distinguished himself as an effective leader, an ironic spirit, a generous spirit, and yet one who is utterly committed to the Lord Jesus Christ and to his word. And you are blessed to have him. I'm impressed that he had the resources to be able to underwrite this conference. I guess you have to have the kind of money Union has to do that. I don't know how, if only we had those kind of resources at Wheaton. I am very much honored to be here, and I mean that I say that genuinely, not in a perfunctory way. It is a blessing to be here. It is a sense of coming home. When I come back to this part of the country, we loved living in the Mid-South. We think of Memphis in many ways as home. It's where our children went through their most formative years. They wound up going to the University of Tennessee for their university years. We have so many deep friends there in the Memphis area. We're Yankees, and we regularly heard, you know, them giving us a warm welcome as Southerners typically do, by saying, you know, for Yankees, you're not too bad. And we love the community of Memphis and that community of believers. You know, I've been asked to address this subject. We're here at a conference entitled Southern Baptist Evangelicals and the Future of Denominationalism. And on the surface of things, that just triggers for us three topics. Obviously, Southern Baptists and evangelicals and denominationalism. All are involved in that. But of course, these three topics converge into a single topic that I think is really the subtext of that title and of a conference like that, and that is sort of whither the SBC, you know, where is the SBC going? You can actually see that in the title of President Dockery's latest book, Southern Baptist Identity, An Evangelical Denomination Faces the Future. This issue of who is the SBC and where is it going? The SBC, once again, it strikes me as an outsider, finds itself wrestling with its identity, its calling, its future. This is not the first time this topic has come up, of course. Many of us watched up close and personal, though as outsiders, watched what the SBC went through over the last three decades or so, and with no little pain. The SBC made some very painful decisions about what it was going to be and what it wasn't going to be. You, the SBC, asked some difficult questions, and you gave some difficult answers, and you're living with those answers today. The problem is those sorts of questions don't stay answered. The environment around us, all of us, us individually, us corporately, keeps changing. And often it keeps buffeting us, and all the more in this generation. It's constantly throwing up new questions to us, questions we can't avoid. And so you wind up with the title of a conference like this. It does not pose the same questions the SBC attempted to answer over the last quarter century. It poses the new question of what it means to live out that previous answer in the kaleidoscopic environment of the 21st century. And I think that is a vital question for all of us, but we're here talking about the SBC's answer to that question. And I would love to offer this group some help. I think it remains to be seen whether I can do that. As David said, I'm not a prophet. In fact, I would quote a good friend and colleague, Walter Kaiser. Many of you know Walter. One of his favorite lines is to say, I am neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, and I work for a nonprofit organization. If you've been around Walter very often, sooner or later you're going to hear that line. It's a great line. Feel free to use it. Give Walt credit for it, I suppose. But there is a great deal I don't know about the SBC, and I'm going to be careful not to be pontificating, not to mention all the things I don't know about the future, and especially the future of evangelicalism. But I want to offer you what I can today. I want to speak to you from what I do know, and then you can decide whether it's of any use to you. I want to turn to the first two of those subjects that I mentioned that are part of this conference, denominationalism and evangelicalism. And then I want to finish by sort of turning to the third, the SBC and its future and its relationship to evangelicalism. I'll just touch very quickly on the first one, denominationalism. I don't have a lot to say about this. The matter is a very complex one, and I want to leave real substantive answers to the people who spend their lives studying that question. It's a very complicated question. Sounds simple, but any time you have trends of this size and depth and the changes, you really have to be studying it closely to really be on top of it. So I'll leave it to the experts to be making pronouncements about it. But the common wisdom has it that denominationalism is in decline. We've already been talking about that here at the conference. It's usually attributed, I think, to generational changes, and those generational changes are very real. I was just reading a couple of books this past summer. I've got another one on my desk right now about this current generation coming up, the so-called millennials, and what marks them. I'm not big on all these kind of generational arguments. I think oftentimes they're coming up with new generations just to sell some more books. But I think the notion of the millennial generation makes a lot of sense. It rings true with the students that we're taking in that I see. One of the books I read this summer is called The Net Gen, and it's focusing in particular on that generation of students who have never known anything but the internet. I mean, most of us in this room Most of our lives were lived without the internet. And we've adapted to it and use it effectively, but we don't swim in its water the way this generation of students do. And making the point that even things like the physical wiring of the brain was shaped, it was being developed, was coming into place as they are immersed in this digital world. And they may even be hardwired differently than some previous generations, our generations. And what does it all mean? Well, we know that there are some real changes generationally. And we can see the retreat from hierarchy, the retreat from organizations, organizational behavior, organizational loyalties. I think sometimes of Tip O'Neill, Speaker Tip O'Neill's famous quip that all politics is local. You wonder sometimes which, if not all church, is also very local. And the further we get away from the local, the less just this generation is going to be interested. And I don't think this is all bad. I think there are a lot of denominational things and denominations themselves that leave a lot to be desired. Up to a point, I think, moving away from undue denominationalism may be taking us closer to a biblical pattern. Of course, that can be taken to an extreme. Many of us have read over the past year or two George Barna's book, Revolution, where he's really talking about it, and he's saying it with some affirmation. I think it's a mark of ill health in the body of Christ, but he's talking about how even not only a retreat from denominationalism, but even a retreat from the local church, even the local church becomes dispensable and is being replaced by small pockets of fellowship and Bible study groups or something. And you don't need a church anymore. It's like, I think this is tragic if this trend actually winds up with those kinds of developments that cannot be healthy. But nonetheless, there are some real changes in this business of how we do denominationalism in America, and those changes have implications for the SBC. Let me return to that just briefly at the end. But denominationalism, one of the subjects of this conference. Let me move to the subject, however, that I've really been called here to address, and that is the issue of evangelicalism. But even here, I do not want to speak as one having authority. I want to be very careful because, again, there are people who study evangelicalism in a very rigorous, in-depth, scholarly way, and as a busy president, that is not one of my options. I'm coming to this today as a participant, not a scholar researcher. My comments come to you as one who is immersed. If ever the metaphor of the forest and the trees applies, it's right here. I live my life with my nose pressed up against the trees of evangelicalism in America. And I'm coming to you really with that sort of a witness rather than claiming any sort of scholarly analysis of the evangelical world. But let me give you, at least from that participant's point of view, my take on some of these things. And I have to say, I want to offer you a Wheaton's eye view of evangelicalism. I don't make any apologies for that. Wheaton has been, during most of the 20th century, really a center for this thing called evangelicalism in America. There may be debates, have been, probably still are in the SBC, debates about whether the SBC belongs within evangelicalism or not. Pastoring there in Memphis, one of my good friends in Memphis was Adrian Rogers. And Adrian would make a point of the fact we are not evangelicals, we are Baptists, you know. He wanted to distinguish himself from the evangelical world while having great sympathy for it and us having wonderful fellowship. He wanted to be sure that we all understood that Baptists are not evangelicals. And that may still, to some extent, be going on within the SBC. But no one ever debates about Wheaton being an evangelical institution. It is often seen as a flagship of American evangelicalism. And I think there's truth to that. In fact, the city of Wheaton became sort of a mecca for American evangelicalism. You know, as Muslims turn to Mecca to pray, so do evangelicals turn to Wheaton to pray when they go to prayer. You look at what's there. It's not just Wheaton College, but you just look at over the years, over the 20th century, what came there. Christianity Today, these mission agencies, the publishers, the churches, one thing after another. The college was at the center of that. You say, why did all these evangelical institutions actually gather in the city of Wheaton? Well, it was because Wheaton College was already there as this evangelical flagship institution going back to 1860. Wheaton and the city of Wheaton, the college and the city of Wheaton came into existence at right the same time. Next year, 2010, is our sesquicentennial, 150 years from the founding of Wheaton College for Christ and His kingdom. So that school had been there for a very long time and was strong and steady by the time American 20th century evangelicalism was coming into existence in the 30s and 40s, really starting to come into its own. And so they gathered there, congealing, so to speak, this evangelical community around Wheaton College. Today, a great many of these have departed, mainly for economic reasons. It's a very expensive place to live. There is a sort of evangelical diaspora that has taken place away from Wheaton to places like Colorado Springs or, who knows, all around the world. But my great concern with you today, and this is really the bulk of what I want to say to you, is that it almost appears to me that that diaspora of evangelicalism may be a useful metaphor for the movement itself. It begins to capture for us the sprawl of American evangelicalism. I'm going to put up a few slides here, pretty bare-bone PowerPoint stuff. You'll pop that up. We'll go with it. I'm going to give you a very quick survey here, and we'll use this as a way of thinking about this. Again, I want to be very low-tech. I mean, the production values here are just pretty simple stuff, but I'm again giving you a Wheaton's eye view. Wheaton was begun in 1860. And for most of its history, for that early part of its history, almost all of it, it was a part of the fundamentalist movement. There's no question the latter part of the 19th century and into the early part of the 20th century, Wheaton was a hotbed of what was becoming, who came into existence, and then all through the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the early 20th century, Wheaton was right there in the middle of what we think of as American fundamentalism. And then you come to the rise of what we think of as American evangelicalism, and really it comes into existence sort of the 20s, 30s, 40s. It's coming into existence, and by the time you get into the 40s and 50s and 60s, it has really come into its own, and it's highly generative of all these organizations and various kinds of instruments, publications. It really starts what we think of as 20th century American evangelicalism is really sort of that green line there. And Wheaton shifts over to that green line. And notice that it's sort of a demographic shift, or in some ways a shift, some other types of shifts. But one shift that it wasn't was a theological shift. If you go back to mid-20th century, the theology, I mean, everybody made the point. When evangelicalism, Carl Henry and others of his generation were calling this into existence, everybody was quite vocal about the fact there isn't really a theological shift going on here. We evangelicals believe the same thing that the fundamentalists believe for all practical purposes. The shift was in other areas, out of a spirit, a breadth, a lack of polemics, wanting to break out of the circled wagons of fundamentalism, wanting to break free of an intellectual ghetto that fundamentalism had put itself into, wanting to embrace the intellectual task, believing that God has given us a mind as well as a spirit. And it was just a less belligerent, a less militant. That's what happens in that shift, but it's not really a theological shift, at least not in major ways. I suppose the red line probably was more millenarian than the green line, but even there, the green line still had quite a strong millenarian tone to it, actually, if you go back and look at it. So Wheaton shifts, and it's now a part of that evangelical, but theologically, it's what it had been before. But it shifts in terms of its spirit and its openness to the intellectual engagement and engagement with the world over into the green line. And then, as we get later in the 20th century, you wind up with something like this. And what you discover is this shift in what we think of as American evangelicalism and a broadening out in what I've come to think of as a sprawl that we are living with today called evangelicalism. Evangelicalism started out fairly tight theologically, fairly well-defined, and it wasn't because a group of people sat down and said, look, let's define it this way. It was something that it gelled out of the early decades of the 20th century and came into fruition and had some leading lights and voices that were articulating it. But there was a oneness of theological focus. If you had asked what does evangelical mean during that time, you would have gotten some fairly clear and fairly specific answers. But by the time we get to this latter part, that starts to break down. The movement could never stay that tight. The result has been, I think, increasingly a loss of definition. You can see it already in the 70s with things like Harold Enzell's book, The Battle for the Bible. You know, I lived through all of that. I'm talking here about my history. I'm 65. I remember vividly. I've been a child of this movement from day one. I'm talking about my own history that I lived through, and from my probably middle teens, I was paying attention. These things mattered to me, and I was living them. And I still remember back in the 70s, the discussions, the issues that were roiling the waters of evangelicalism, and it's epitomized for me in Lindzell's book, which came out and was created quite a furor and ongoing battle. It's called The Battle for the Bible, but the truth is that book and the underlying problems beneath it wasn't really a battle for the Bible. I mean, the people representing the two sides of what Lindzell describes had been there all along. I mean, it's not like something new was coming. The question was, which is going to be ascendant? This was a discussion. It wasn't a battle for the Bible. It was a battle for the term evangelical. And the essential question that Lindzell and others are asking is inerrancy inherent in being an evangelical? Can you be an evangelical and not hold to inerrancy? In other words, it's a battle over the semantic boundaries of this term, because the term then has demographic implications as to who is an evangelical of this movement and who isn't. And that's what was going on. And once you get to that kind of a struggle, you can see already this sprawl, this widening. And there was no way to legislate a technical definition for this issue, for any term like evangelical. You can't turn it into a technical term. You know, technical terms have a formal, tight definition. You'll find them in all sorts of technical work where everybody decides this will be the technical definition. But outside, after that, every other term is this semantic something that's constantly growing. Language constantly changes. It's like a great sand dune that's just constantly moving. And so is language like that, and terms are like that, and they never stay still. And evangelical, the term evangelical, was moving, and there was increasingly sprawl. And you could see the evangelical movement trying to keep some boundaries on this thing, keep a lid on this sprawling that was taking place, and you had a lot of the issues were around inerrancy. You had the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy and then the Chicago Statement that came out of that and a whole series of things that came up from that time. You can see a movement that is by this point worried about its own definition. Who are we? What are we about? And I would say that sprawl has only continued since then. Evangelicalism has no ability to prevent this kind of sprawl from happening. The movement, I mean, has no ability to prevent itself from sprawling. Evangelicalism cannot police itself. The SBC was sprawling. I was ordained in the American Baptist Church. Been there, done that. I know what a sprawl looks like in a Baptist denomination. And a lot of it was just a decade or two behind, but the SBC was moving. And the SBC rose up and said, no, we're not going there, and tightened itself significantly. I don't have any brief to make for the way it was done. I watched it, again, up close and personal, knowing some key people who were in the middle of the whole thing. I was living in Dallas through much of this and knew some of the people involved. And it seems to me, as an outsider looking on, that there was a needless amount of blood left on the floor. But having said that, I think the SBC needed to stand up and police itself and to say, this is who we are and this is not who we are. And you've done that. And again, you're probably still wrestling with some of the after effects of that today, and maybe will for a long time. Evangelicalism has no ability to do that. It can't stand up and say, hold it, this is who we are, this is not who we are. There's nobody to do that. The movement simply is what it is. The semantics of the term is what it is, and there's no way to police that. I think ETS, the Evangelical Theological Society, keeps trying to do that. But notice ETS is really, and in my estimation, needs to do that, but notice that ETS is just policing itself. It's not policing the movement or policing the term. It can set the boundaries for itself, but even there, it struggles to do that. The movement cannot do that. And this tendency to sprawl, this broadening that seems now to me almost inevitable, has only continued from that period on till today. And if you look out into the future, where is it all going to go? I think there are reasons why the movement called evangelicalism has sprawled even more and probably will continue to do so. One of the reasons is the issues that evangelicalism is dealing with are more complex than they were back in this, you know, sort of the heyday, where things were still pretty tightly defined. You get out here, what has happened in these intervening years to the issues that are at stake? You go back and read the Chicago Statement on Inerrancy, and it almost sounds quaint. Back when all of that was going on, both sides of that debate were fundamentally working off a similar set of epistemological assumptions. Well, today, that epistemological framework is long gone, certainly in the culture as a whole, and even for within and among those who still want to use the term evangelical for themselves. The issues of truth and error, and whether the Bible has some error in it or it doesn't have any error in it, is almost quaint in the sense of the assumptions being made about the nature of truth and the nature of error. And as we've moved toward the latter part of the 20th century, and we've seen the problems that were there in a superstructure, sort of fissures, metastasized, that mix my metaphors, metastasized down into the foundation of hermeneutics and epistemology, to where when you look at where we are today with this constructivist approach to everything. You know, back then, here there was a sort of working critical realism that in one form or another was informing people on all sides within the evangelical community in this debate. And the further out you go, the less there is uniformity on these underlying hermeneutical and epistemological issues. And here again, that has a tendency to prompt a certain sprawl within the movement. And I would add to that, I think, some other things culturally that were going on during this same period, from sort of back here where things were probably relatively tight. And we weren't even asking the definition of evangelical. There wasn't any big debate about it. Everybody kind of knew what it was, and it had just come into its own, but it didn't stay that way. And so you're moving out. Think of some of the other things that happened from here on out to where we are today. All you have to do is think about, I mean, that was the rise of evangelicalism into a place of hegemony in the culture, a place of real influence. From having been back in the 20s and 30s nowhere, and mainline Christianity was all that was the future, and the fundamentalists were in their circled wagons and beleaguered. Well, by the time you get to the middle of the century, evangelicalism is up on its hind legs and moving, and missions and evangelism and intellectual work and institutions, schools, and so on. You see things coming on. Until by the time you get into the 70s, you know, now you got the famous Time magazine cover, you know, the year of the evangelicals and Jimmy Carter and all this other stuff, where suddenly they're coming on, and you get this thing starting to exert its muscle, and you get the moral majority and other things like that stepping up. So evangelicalism coming into this place is saying, hey, we got a place here in this culture, and we can exercise some muscle. And they did exercise the muscle with the pushback you would expect from the culture, and you get the pushback that we've seen sort of ever since, and the tendency of the people on the other side of the issues, you know, sort of winding up with this undifferentiated thing called the religious right and reacting against the religious right. And right during this same period, you find evangelicals in many ways riding high, but you also have this just seemed like this unseemly parade of evangelical scandals, high-profile scandals, that every time we hit another one, you know, we would cringe. I think, oh, Lord, protect us from ourselves. And that, you know, those scandals just kept coming, and they, you know, we haven't escaped them yet. They come periodically for us now. It's very painful for us to see that happening. And all that does is we're giving ammunition over to those who are pushing back on evangelicalism. And then you add to that our tendency toward moralism or self-righteousness sometimes squirts out and so on. And you wind up with giving the opponents of evangelicalism a great amount of ammunition. In fact, I would take it even further as I look at myself, look at our movement, my crowd, this world of evangelicalism. I think the problem is in some ways even deeper even than that analysis. I think maybe the underlying problem that we have in the culture in this period, especially, it would go back here if we traced it, but I see it especially here because I've lived through this, is the problem of having been, evangelicalism have been co-opted by Americanism, by American consumerism. I really worry about that. And I think if we knew the truth, we would understand the degree to which this has undermined our ability to exercise influence in the culture. You know, all of us remember Dan Quayle's famous remark about Murphy Brown. He gave that speech. Dan Quayle, former vice president, gave that speech, and he just tossed off a few lines. It wasn't some big burn on he had. He just used that as an example, literally just a handful of sentences about this TV character, Candace Bergen, playing this character of a single woman who decides to have a baby, doesn't need a father, and she's impregnated, and so she has this baby out of wedlock. And he's calling that into question in this speech. And he doesn't come on particularly strong. He just says, what a bad example. And you'll remember he was absolutely savaged by the media. I mean, they just raked him over the coals. And to this day, that's a laughingstock reference, the Murphy Brown reference by Dan Quayle. I remember right about that same time, I was at the National Prayer Breakfast, and Mother Teresa was the speaker. And she stood up at that prayer breakfast with Bill Clinton sitting right here beside her. And she stood up and stuck her finger in the face of America and said, "You, Mr. President, you must stop this Holocaust of killing these innocent babies. America, if you don't want your babies, give them to me." I mean, she just, this prophetic word about the evils of abortion in America. And I watched the media afterwards, and they treated her with absolute kid gloves. Never touched her. You say, what's the difference? Dan Quayle could step up and say something relatively minor and get savaged, and Mother Teresa steps up and has this prophetic word and is treated with kid gloves. What's the difference? Well, the difference is the moral credibility of these two. It's probably unfair to Dan Quayle, I'm sure it is, but his image is that of affluent, comfortable, upper middle class, superficial, plastic, judgmental. Whereas Mother Teresa has this lifetime behind her of sacrificial giving of herself for others. I've got all kinds of theological problems with Mother Teresa, but I cannot gainsay the level of self-sacrifice that marked her life. And that self-sacrifice gave her a moral credibility with American culture that a Dan Quayle simply didn't have. And I put that contrast on the table to say this. I think American evangelicalism looks to our culture a lot more like Dan Quayle than it looks like Mother Teresa. And then we wonder why we have so little clout, so little opportunity for, so little moral credibility to stand up and speak and to be taken seriously instead of dismissed and ravaged by the media. Well, for all of these reasons, I think the sprawl is just going to keep happening. It's hard for me to see what can stop that. We're living with the results of all of this. The best we seem to be doing is David Bebbington's definition that Timothy mentioned to us in chapel this morning, the biblicism, crucicentrism, conversionism, activism. And these are, every one of them, fine as far as they go, but it seems to me they represent a pretty minimalist definition. Not least because all four of these terms are fairly broad in themselves, much less are there other things that really should be added to that list. I think the further you go, well, I did it. I went backwards. There we go. I think the further you go back here, the less satisfactory that minimalist definition would have been. In fact, if you do go back and you look at some of the things that were being published back then by evangelicals about evangelical theology, whole books of theology, collected books on theology. I have several of them sitting on my shelf at home, edited by Carl Henry and some others. I mean, there's a lot of specificity, and it's good specificity. It's strong. It's biblical. It's strong, solid theology. Well, this fourfold definition is fine as far as it goes, but it represents a whole lot of breadth. 40 years ago, those four terms probably would have required more specificity, but not today. And so we observe today the very brave, and I commend it, but also in some ways to me the rather sad spectacle of one of our leading lights, one of our key voices in evangelicalism, of D.A. Carson, Don Carson, in his new book that's coming out next spring. And catch the title of the book, Evangelicalism. What is it, and is it worth keeping? In this book, I think the title says it all. Don attempts to answer his question by defining the movement, trying to give it some definition, and arguing, yes, it is worth keeping. And I hope he's successful. But I also want to say that the fact that we need a book with a title like that is not a good sign. So what does all this mean for the SBC? I'll try to land this airplane and see if we can open it up and just have some discussion. First of all, three observations as SBC. And this is coming to you as an outsider, and I'm profoundly aware that I know that I don't know. You know a whole lot more than I do, and I'm just as an outsider, and this is a for what it's worth set of observations. First, I think Baptist polity is in some ways well positioned for the decline of denominationalism. To track with this, with the strong emphasis on the absence of hierarchical structures, minimizing that, the strong emphasis on the autonomy of the local church, the localism that's built into Baptist polity, it seems to me that even if denominationalism is in decline, that the there we go. We got it back again. It seems to me that there are ways in which the SBC might be able to hold on to some of the real benefits of a denominational life, denominational structure, without some of the drawbacks of denominationalism, and there are some. You may see more and more of what we've already been talking about here. It showed up in the handout this morning at Harry Poe's presentation. Ways in which the SBC is already seeing itself, its churches, its internal organizations, playing down the Baptist, playing down the SBC connection without severing the connection or leaving it behind, nor is it being waved in people's faces. And you see churches and other organizations, you see the SBC doing that. Once you plunge in, I can point to several just that I'm aware of, much less the things that you're aware of. Actually, I think that may be a pretty good strategy. Maintain the strengths of what a denominational, what we can do when we work together, but also stay away from some of the kinds of things that the generation that we're after right now, that we have to address and engage, they're really not interested in that. It seems to me the SBC may be well positioned to keep that balance out into the future. A second observation. I do think these developments may well force the SBC to become less insular. The Southern Baptist Convention has long enjoyed the luxury of insularity. You have your own churches, your own schools, colleges, universities, publishers, Sunday school material, mission agencies, and you could be very interior because you've got the whole complement of what you need within the boundaries of the SBC, and so you could be very insular. And I could tell you some insular stories, SBC stories, of my own experience of that insularity as an outsider. During the latter half of the 20th century, it seems to me that insularity has been in the process of breaking down. There are those voices who certainly wanted to keep it insular, and you may have some of those left within the SBC, but many others wanted to participate with the broader evangelical world. And the result is that many have broken out of the SBC ghetto, so to speak. And I think I want to commend you for that. You have joined, the Southern Baptist Convention has joined the broader evangelical world. And you can see it in your publishing house. You can see it in a variety of ways, one of the places where I've seen it up close is in the CCCU, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, about 105 or so Christian colleges and universities. And if you go back even as late as maybe 20 years ago or 25 years ago, there were almost no Southern Baptist schools in the midst of the CCCU. Well, today there are, with David Dockery and Union among the leaders of the CCCU. This is the SBC breaking out of its insularity and really becoming a part of the broader evangelical world. And I think those who have been doing this all along were prescient, in my estimation, not least because I think that kind of insularity is going to be more and more difficult to maintain. As an outsider, I would say it's a good thing that you do this. I would encourage you to participate everywhere you can as Southern Baptists, with whomever you can, do it without compromising the truth. You need to work, really work, all of us do, every one of us, work at maintaining that ironic spirit. Avoid insularity. You can learn from others by hanging out with them, believe it or not. You'll be better for it, but equally, you can have a good influence if you're part of the conversation, that broader conversation. And I would say, from my point of view, sitting where I do in the catbird seat, it's sort of this, like the spider at the center of this evangelical world, there at Wheaton, I would say we need you. We need the SBC voice. I've seen it in the CCCU. Having these schools and these voices step in, the broader evangelical world needs to have the Southern Baptist Convention. You and the people you represent and the voices you represent sitting at the table in that conversation, we need you there. So I think insularity will be less open, less available to you, but take that as an opportunity, because we need you as a part of the broader evangelical conversation. But I would say thirdly, and here this is really sort of dangerous for me to say this for a couple of reasons. I would say don't depend upon the evangelicalism as a movement. Don't put your eggs in the basket of evangelicalism per se. I say that not because I'm willing or ready to write off evangelicalism. I think there are times when we need to do that. In fact, I think one of the great principles of life is, if the horse is dead, dismount. and organizational behavior tends to resist that. If we've had it all along, it's failure if we call an end to it. No, nothing lasts forever except the Lord. And so I think there are times when that's exactly what we need to do. But am I willing to say evangelicalism is a dead horse? We need to dismount? Absolutely not. I think that would be very premature. I think the NAE actually is stronger than it was just a few years ago. Some good leadership from Leith Anderson and some others. I think Christianity Today remains a very important organ. ETS, I think, makes an important contribution that we would be much less for if we didn't have it. I value the label evangelical, still use it. Still use it at Wheaton College. But if I'm honest, I will also say to some extent and in some ways that term works against me and what I'm trying to do at Wheaton College. Because evangelicalism is broader now than is Wheaton College. And there are things going on and voices who still want to identify themselves, not still, but maybe newly want to identify themselves as evangelical because the semantics of the term have broadened out that can now include them, that they're espousing things. I'm looking and say, no, Wheaton isn't going there. But then I'll have somebody say, well, what about so-and-so? So-and-so is an evangelical, and we're an evangelical institution. Why shouldn't we have that here at Wheaton? I'm saying, no. The term actually starts to work against me once it starts broadening out and can sometimes get in my way. And I would say the same thing to you. I do not think you and the SBC should distance yourself from evangelicalism. You are an evangelical group. And I would say don't fight it. Plunge in. Participate. We need you there. Just don't put too much weight on it. Don't have undue expectations about what this means. Movements, terms, labels, they come and go. They don't last. As for you, and I say this to myself, as for Wheaton College and as for me as an individual, I want to keep myself, I want to keep us anchored in the truth. Movements come and go, terms, labels come and go. I'm not, whatever the semantics of evangelical is, that's who we are, that's disastrous. We have to be anchored in the truth. And I would say for you, you should do what we try to do at Wheaton. Keep yourselves anchored biblically. Stay Christ-centered, gospel-centered, word-centered. This is what will keep you useful to the Lord. And if you do this, and you do it as a part of the evangelical movement, the Lord may well use the SBC to keep evangelicalism relevant deep into the 21st century. Well, that's the end of what I want to say to you, except I have one more thing to say, and then we'll open it up. And I toyed with whether to say this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. I'm going to tell you my best Southern Baptist story. And if you've heard this before, bear with me, but if not, you'll probably find this useful and you'll wind up repeating it. It's about three pastors who were commiserating. They all had the same problem in their churches. They had bats in the auditorium and they couldn't get rid of them. And so they were commiserating about what to do about it. And they turned to the Presbyterian guy and said, "What did you do?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what we did. I went in there with a .22 rifle and tried picking them off." He said, "We didn't get a single one. And left some holes in the roof. We had to stop doing that." So he said, "We still have our bats. We haven't found a way to get rid of them." Turned to the Methodist guy and said, "Well, how about you?" He said, "Well, we didn't want to injure them, but we went in there during the day while they were sleeping, and we caught them. We took them out to the local forest, and we released them, and they were back before we were. You know, we still have our bats. We've not been able to get rid of them. How about you?" They turned to the Southern Baptist guy. He said, "Well, actually, we've gotten rid of our bats." I said, "You did? How did you do it?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what I did. We went in there and caught those bats. I brought them down. I baptized them. I had them join the church, and we've never seen them since." I told you, you could use that. If you haven't heard that before, you can use that one. Let's open it up. We have some Q&A, David? Let's do it. Somebody keep us on time. Okay, 10 or 12 minutes, and somebody will say no more. You want to open it up? And not just questions. I don't have all the answers. Any comments? You want to add anything? You want to argue with me?
Yeah, there's a mic right there he's going to give you. Or not. I think maintaining your theological identity and maintaining your theological commitments is crucial. And, you know, the evangelicalism is by definition built of this group of people who have all kinds of things in common. People who often complain about evangelicalism as a weak ecclesiology, and it does. Evangelicalism has a very little doctrine of the church. And why is that? Because it's this group made up of people from across all sorts of boundaries. And when you talk about the church polity, talk about even the Lord's Supper or baptism or something, evangelicals start going different directions. But what do evangelicals hold in common? And I would say you don't have to give up any of your Baptist distinctives to be fully fledged evangelicals. And I would urge you to hold on to all those distinctives as a matter of conviction. Having said that, do I think it's worth trying to define this movement? I'm coming out of my training, part of my training is in the field of communication. I'm just telling you, you cannot legislate a term. I hope what Don Carson is doing in this book is really taking us back to the evangel and trying to anchor us again in the core meaning, the historic meaning of evangelical. Man, if he's successful, if he can do that, if we'll all rally around that, I'll be the first one to applaud. If you ask me standing up here, do I think that's going to be successful? I think we're spitting into the wind. I just think these things are not something we have control over. So trying to define it, trying to insist on this is, and by definition that isn't, I just think that gets harder and harder as the sprawl takes place in some ways, what you have to do is come up with new terms. And, you know, the history of theology is famous of it, especially the doctrine of Scripture. You know, it was the Scripture is authoritative. No, it's infallible. No, it's, you know, you just keep going, the verbal and plenary inspired. And then it's, you know, all the way through, you know, it's inerrant. And it's, all of this has to do with trying to find language keeps shifting on you. You got to keep coming up with new language to describe. I think the key is to be crystal clear on where you're anchored in the truth. And then the language, the labels you use for that, they're going to change on you, and you don't have a lot to do with it. I hope it's successful. I just think we're probably, the cat is out of the bag in terms of the definition of evangelical. And maybe I'm overly skeptical. I told you, I'm coming at this as someone, my nose pressed up to the trees. I'm often discouraged by what I see in my own evangelical world. There are times when I said if I had someplace else to go, I would go there. I can't go to Rome. I can't go to Orthodoxy. I can't go to liberalism. The emergent church doesn't excite me, taking us where we need to go. Evangelicalism is my crowd, and that's why I get disappointed at seeing the unraveling that just seems to be. I wish we could go back to a very clear, tight definition. I just don't think that's possible. Maybe I'm being overly skeptical. Some of you want to argue with me, feel free. Yeah. Greg?
When I was growing up in Pennsylvania, we used to have this little phrase, my hope is built on nothing less than Schofield's notes and Moody Press, which then goes back to Wheaton. And I'm wondering if the sprawl is less a loss of identity and more a loss of a kind of tribalism or culture or cultural moment. And in a way, it's success because we've diversified, we've gotten more multi-ethnic, we have different expressions, we have different kinds of churches than would have been the case, you know, before the neo-evangelical movement. So is it all bad that there's sprawl? Is there a cultural diversification?
There are two things happening at the same time. The tent gets bigger and bigger, and so you have less and less of a core to make sure everybody in the tent holds this core. But the broader you get, the less of a core you have to. It's, those two things are inevitable. And I see the sprawl in terms of the loss of this core, a watering down of this core. Now, you could be sort of, you know, making it more and more essential. And maybe these four fairly broad terms we're down to the core now, and we'll hold on to those four, and we'll give them real substance, and we'll stay there. Maybe. We certainly have a bigger tent, and we have a smaller core. Maybe we're down to the essentialist core, and this is a healthy place to be. Maybe you're right.
Do you feel like the greatest, crisis or the urgency of the definition has to do with the relationship of movement to its institutions? So because people have a hard time supporting institutions, but they can identify them with a particular path that they have a clear identity. And those institutions, if the evangelical movement is broad and the institution is trying to have a more narrow identity, then is there a problem of a supportive institution? That's where the real crisis of identity becomes.
You bet. I mean, absolutely. If I can go around telling people we're an evangelical institution and that has some meaning, that's a huge help to me. That's a great shorthand. If I lose the term evangelical, in other words, it no longer works for us because the semantics have become so slippery that the specific thing Wheaton is not being communicated anymore, then I've got to, until I come up with a new term or we come up with a new term to designate this rather than this, how do I communicate to my constituency and draw their support? That it makes the challenge much harder. There's no question of that, just in terms of communicating ourselves to a broader audience. You know, I would love to hold on to the term evangelical. Like I said, I haven't abandoned it. But I just see too often it saying something to people beyond what I'm willing to say about myself or even about the institution. And Wheaton is a fairly broad institution, not like Wheaton is some tightly defined thing. You know, Wheaton is fairly broad. But there are things being called evangelical today, and everybody relaxed about that. Oh, yeah, that's an evangelical that I look at and say, no, I don't want us to go there. So how do I address this problem? It's an ongoing challenge for us because of the semantics is letting us down.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the key thing about the knowledge
Well, in some ways, the answer probably is yes. I mean, again, what we would like is nice shorthand definitions that a David Dockery or a Duane Litvin can say to people, this is who we are, and everybody knows, oh, that's who they are. And the language you're using is clear to everybody. That's who they are. What happens when that language breaks down? And it's this. And you say you're evangelical, but a thoughtful person says, tell me what that means. Because the term evangelical can mean a lot of different things. That's where we are today. And I face that very dilemma all the time. One of the reasons what you're hearing from me is I live with this dilemma of saying we're an evangelical institution and have people say, what does that mean? There's stuff I hear about evangelical. You're saying Wheaton stands there, and I say, well, actually, no. You know, that's our dilemma. Yes, you're saying, does that give us an ever greater dilemma as an institution? You bet. And you guys have sort of a double whammy because you're a Southern Baptist school, but you're also evangelical. And the denomination is changing and has changed over the last 25 years and continues to. And then you got this evangelical thing I've been talking about. And so how do you communicate to your constituency who you are? I do not want to leave you with the impression I think the language evangelical is worthless and chuck it. I don't. I use it. I'm just saying, I'm saying if you look at the future of evangelicals, I'm afraid it's this. And this is going to be ever more of a challenge for us. And I don't think we can legislate a solution to it. Yeah. I'm sorry, I thought you... You're here.
So it becomes a challenge because we try to draw the best folks we can academically out there in the world. And maintaining that balance of people who are credible academically, are conversive in the broader discussions that are going on, but at the same time staying grounded in an Orthodox perspective theologically becomes challenging.
David Dockery and I both could tell you some anecdotes, we won't, but we could, about sister institutions or even our colleagues who, some of the blind spots are astonishing. One of the reasons I wrote that book, Conceiving the Christian College, what is that? It's a series of concepts, ideas, that if we lose this, if we're watering down or diluting these, we're going to lose Christian higher education. And I'm calling us, trying to give some trumpet sounds. I wrote that after a decade in my role, saying, whoa, we need some clear sounds of the trumpet out here. David is excellent at that. You can be very grateful you have a president who's is a clarion call on these issues. And my only point here is that the movement is sprawling, and therefore, or maybe the two just kind of go hand in hand, the language, the semantics of the term is sprawling. So what does that say about the future of not just a union university, but the SBC being an evangelical, you know, I just tell you, that don't put a lot of weight on that term, because that term, you're losing it to define who you are. And in my estimation, I don't think we can pull it back and say, no, we're going to police the definition, we're going to police the movement. I don't think that's doable. Any other comments, and then we'll quit. Somebody want to weigh in, agree, disagree? Yes. Okay. Yeah, if you just look at what you guys went through and you had to sort of draw some lines in the sand and some real blood spilling over those lines in the sand, and you wound up with a whole segment of who were with you before, who were on the other side of that line, and the bulk certainly of the organization and its organizations over here on this side of the line. But to this day, you've got a lot of people who used to be inside the SBC tent and they're not. And and they're often carping at the ones who are and the voices who are in it and the influences. You're just living with that division today. And you made some decisions about who you're going to be and who you're not going to be, and you're living with those decisions today, and I can only say I commend you for that. I think, again, I go back to my experience in the American Baptist Church. If you hadn't done that, if the SBC had not had the grit to step up and do that, I know where you would be today, because I can point to some others. That's where you would be, a lot closer to that. Well, you're not there today. But there are also a number of people who in that process are outside the bounds now of the Southern Baptist Convention represented in a group like this. And I just think it was very painful for us to watch it. Again, I was watching it pretty up close. And I look back at some of the tactics and some of the, it's not like I have great wisdom as to how it could have been done differently. Some, and maybe in some ways there was no way to do it without bloodletting. But there was a lot of blood on the floor when during the process. And I think still, there's still hard feelings. There's still this whole institutions, whole churches and so on who are outside now a circle that you folks represent. And I just, that's what I mean by you're kind of living with the result. I just hate to see a brokenness in the body of Christ. The apostle tells us, you know, work hard to maintain the unity of the body. And yet there are times when you got to stand up for the truth. And then that winds up creating things you didn't really intend, but what can you do? You had to stand up and be counted. And I commend you for that. I do say, having watched some of the tactics that were used really on both sides, it's like, you know, there were times when I was sort of cringing back when, but I try not to be judgmental. I didn't have to walk in your shoes. If I had to do some of these same things at Wheaton, you know, what would I do? So I don't have any great wisdom for that. One last question, yes.
A lot of us for a long time have added the term conservative to that.
Yeah.
Is the problem there that it's got baggage that
Well, conservative has baggage, and the term evangelical has baggage. It's coming. You see these surveys now as to how the average person in America views the term evangelical, views evangelicals, you know, us. And it has become a term of opprobrium in wide swaths of American culture. And then you add conservative evangelical, and certainly to that crowd, you know, it goes deeper into a hole. But, you know, that the adding of conservative is a case in point that I was talking about, that language doesn't stand still. Language moves, terms move, semantics move. And so what do? You have to keep qualifying it, you know, because evangelical used to have built into it conservative. Well, now you have to distinguish it as a conservative evangelical because there are some who are not conservative. You know, you hear the term evangelical Catholics. If you went back to the 1950s or 60s and you said evangelical, that was inherent in being an evangelical, is that it's Protestant. Well, that's not true today. And that's not to say that I'm not criticizing Catholics who really understand the gospel and are trusting and living for Christ faithfully. But what I'm saying is the term used to distinguish something that now it doesn't. Now it includes things, you know. The semantics of the term, we can't control it. And my fear is that it's out of the box. And my only point to you is to say be anchored on the truth. And then as terms come and go, you use the ones that are useful and don't use the ones that aren't useful, but stay anchored in the truth. And that's what we're trying to do at Wheaton. I'll leave you with an illustration that I often find myself using in my own setting, for me and for my institution. I think of Daniel living there in Babylon. Here he is taken away, a young man, into the very heart of paganism, and this environment doing everything it can to pour him into its mold. But he comes to it with some prior commitments that are, his loyalties are clear, and they will not be breached. And he's as winsome as he can be. He's as wise and careful as he can be. There's no combativeness. He's really respectful toward Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't have a chip on his shoulder. There's a sweet spirit about what he's doing, but nor is he going to compromise. And the Lord honors that. And by the end of chapter 1 and then the end of chapter 2, you got Daniel, you know, kind of second in the land. And so, boy, this pagan culture recognized his sheer excellence that came about because of his allegiance to the Lord. It's wonderful to see how that pagan culture raised him up, recognizing his excellence. And then you've got chapter 3 with the fiery furnace with these three young men. And then by chapter 5, you've got him, chapter 6, you got him in the lion's den, surrounded by lions. But notice it's the same Daniel. Whether the culture is saying, right on, excellent, we admire that, or it has you surrounded by lions, or anything in between, Daniel was going to be Daniel was going to be Daniel, you know, steady as she goes. He wasn't overly working to get those accolades. And when they came from Belshazzar in chapter 5, you know, he says, you can keep your rewards, too impressed by those. He wasn't co-opted by it because he was living out his prior allegiance to the Word of God, to the God he served. And that's what I want to be. It's what I want Wheaton to be. Whether the world looks at Wheaton and says, whoa, that's impressive, excellent. Or it says, can you believe what those yahoos are doing? Or anything in between. We want steady as she goes. We want to be faithful to Christ and his kingdom, committed to the lordship of Christ and to the authority and trustworthiness of his word. And if we can just steady as she goes. And sometimes the culture likes you and sometimes the culture doesn't like you. Steady as she goes. Steady as she goes. I think I'd love to see the SBC sold out that way. Not trying to gain accolades unduly, just with excellence, sold out. Do your work with excellence, and if the culture applauds you, great. We love that, and we enjoy that. If the culture doesn't applaud you, well, that's okay too. Most Christians in most places and most times have lived profoundly out of step with their day, their time and place, and paid the price for it. We're the only ones as American Christians who've been so co-opted by this very comfortable environment we've always had that as the culture moves away from us and we find ourselves more and more uncomfortable, saying, whoa, what's going on here? Something's wrong. I'm not comfortable in my own culture anymore. You say, welcome to the body of Christ. You know, we're the only ones who think something's wrong when we find ourselves out of step. Actually, that should be probably standard operating procedure for all of us. God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Lutfen. And if the microphone trouble had to occur, I'm glad it was with someone who'd been a pastor because he's used to that, as you know. But I appreciate so much the word, and he kept referring to he and Dr. Dockery. You know, it's unusual to have college presidents that they have also both been in a role of pastor, too. I think that's why they relate so much to where we are and are so valuable. So thank you so much for being with us and sharing with us. This afternoon, the schedule has moved up just a little bit because we started eating a little bit early. We're going to, after our next session, you're going to have a break until our community-wide service in here tonight with Dr. Smith, but please don't leave. We're going to give you about a 20-minute break, but you don't want to miss hearing Dr. Ray Van Ness. I'm telling you, you don't want to miss that. He'll be introduced a little bit later, but he'll be a blessing, so don't miss that. We're going to dismiss you for about 20 minutes. We'll come back just about 1:30 and get started back. So you're dismissed. Thank you.
check, 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 one, two, check. Yep.